Live from Earth, it's Space Radio. This is Paul Sartor, and coming up, we're going to talk about a space octopus, and unfortunately that is not a joke, and perhaps if I have time, talking about an interstellar visitor that's outstaying its welcome, and of course taking listener questions about all things in the universe, because that's what this show is about. We record every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, so call 888-581-0708 to join the conversation. And in today's Blue Shift, I'll be talking about what peer review really means. But first, the news. Hello, space fans. Welcome to Space Radio. I'm Paul Sutter, astrophysicist at Ohio State, chief scientist at COSINE. For the next half hour, your agent to the stars. We've got an exciting show for you today on Space Radio, where we talk about all things. This show lives on listener questions. We record every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern in Studio A of WCB Radio Columbus. This is a special edition broadcasting from the Grandview Theater in Columbus, Ohio. I've got Johnny DiLoretto next to me. He's not going to appear on the show, but he's there. He's going to wave. You can't see that because we're a part of his 24 on 24 marathon fundraising. That is Thursday. By the time you hear this, it will already be over, but you can still contribute by going to WCB.org. You can also follow along on our live streams on Twitch and YouTube. Check out spaceradioshow.com for the links. We'll take questions that you send there too. Seriously, folks, I've only prepped 10 minutes of show material tops, so get those calls in. Before I start taking calls, though, I wanted to share some interesting bits of news that I caught recently. This story, it didn't get a lot of play. But it caught my eye as an object lesson in honestly, pretty poor science. Pretty poor science journalism. This is something that it sticks in my craw. It sticks in my craw when there's a bad science being reported on even more poorly. But this story has to do with the Cambrian explosion. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Cambrian explosion. It happened about 541 million years ago. Life got started on the Earth a very, very long time ago, around 3 billion years, plus or minus. But it was just, you know, single-celled organisms not doing much, minding their own business, doing complex things, of course, but nothing much more interesting. And then about 541 million years ago, boom. We see fossil evidence of complex, diverse, multicellular creatures going all around, and it was just crazy. It was a nutsoid time to be alive back in the day, and there's a big question of what's going on, like what instigated this biologically, or is it just a bias? Like now creatures started to have, there was more complex stuff earlier, but just the way we get fossils, there's a gap in our knowledge there, not necessarily in the abundance of life in that era. That's a big question. That's a big biology question, certainly outside of my domain expertise, so I don't want to get into it too much, except there was a recent paper which talked about the Cambrian explosion and framed it in terms of astronomy and astrophysical events, and which is something that I can talk about, ha ha ha. And this is a paper by a couple researchers from the University of Oxford in the UK, published in Nature Communications and followed up in later journals very recently. Talking about the Cambrian explosion event and just how it seems like kind of an oddball. And they're pushing a particular line of thinking called panspermia. Panspermia is this idea that life did not originate on Earth, but really originated somewhere else and arrived on Earth by hitching a ride on an asteroid or a comet or whatever. And This is a relatively old idea, at least in scientific circles, much older philosophically, of course, but relatively recent scientifically. One of the big proponents was going around in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, an astronomer named Fred Hoyle, who is a fascinating guy who would basically think of every possible crazy idea and push it as hard as he could. And a good chunk of the time, he was right. He was wrong a few times, but he was a big believer, big proponent of this panspermia idea. Maybe life was on Earth was seeded from somewhere else. And it's not a very popular idea anymore because, one, space is big. And even you can think of the hardiest organisms that can survive the most extreme environments, but then you put them in space for, 2 million years, which is what it would take to cross these vast interstellar distances. And, you know, it seems a little bit slim. And one of the things that these researchers are pointing to is like, well, look at how special the Cambrian explosion is. Maybe the specialness of the Cambrian explosion is because, some DNA material came to Earth and then, you know, kickstarted evolution. I don't know, like, that's not very convincing. The research paper itself isn't laid out very well, doesn't make its arguments very well, and then it goes off in some weird directions, like, hey, points out that the octopus is relatively strange, has some special features that not any other life on Earth has. Most life evolves by modifying its DNA, but the octopus is able to evolve by modifying its RNA. Again, I'm not an expert here, so I may be speaking beyond my expertise. And they point to that and say, hey, maybe the octopus is special because it came from space? And it's at that point that you're like, come on, guys, you had barely a good idea that you were barely pushing, like already you were on thin ice, and then you're gonna say octopodes, I believe is the plural, is where you're gonna go with this? Okay, like you lost me, like there's nothing there. Like, honestly, I know in science we have to always hedge our bets and speak, with all the proper modifiers and weasel words but come on. Come on, you really expect me to believe, or any other scientist or the general public to believe, the octopodes came from space, and that's your argument that the octopodes, is so hard to get that plural word out, the octopodes are special, therefore life came from space, but then you can go even further in this line of argument, say, okay, life didn't originate on Earth, it came from somewhere else, where did it originate from? And then the authors of this paper said, well, maybe our universe has been around forever, so there's been a starting point, but we know our universe hasn't been around forever, we know the Big Bang cosmology picture is largely correct, happy to do an entire episode just on that, if you want to ask about that, feel free. And that's where we are. Like, you got nothing, folks. You just got nothing. Like, you're not moving me. I'm surprised this made it through to even be mentioned in the news. But there it is. But that's the latest and greatest when it comes to space. It's time to have a conversation. Today is a very special recording day because I'm over at the Grand View Theater. We are not taking calls. We just don't have the call-in studio system set up, and I don't have Greg in the booth managing the calls. So I'm only taking questions from the live stream today. And a very interesting question came up from the Space Cadets on YouTube. Yamagishi-san asked about parallel universes. And if there were other universes, would they intersect with us? Could we reach them? Could we touch them? We know our universe is expanding. If there was another, say, Big Bang event next door doing its thing with its expanding universe, with its galaxies getting further away from each other, if you can imagine these two bubbles intersecting, and then maybe there are intelligent octopodes floating around in that universe and we could not shake hands, but hand to tentacle, you know how it goes. Could we have a conversation with them? Is there any path to testing if there are alternative universes in some larger multiverse, grand universe kind of structure? And the answer is yes. In some models of the very, very early universe, I'm talking about the first second of the universe, very early universe, in some models, there are multiple events that we would identify as Big Bang events, occurring simultaneously, in fact, occurring all the time. And they would each lead to a universe that, like an entire self-contained observable bubble of the universe, containing trillions of galaxies and a very, very large number of stars, and so on and so forth. Effectively, it is totally 100% impossible to travel from one universe to another, one bubble universe to another bubble universe, because The universe is expanding faster than the speed of light at its very distant edges. Maybe back in the day, life was a little bit different. Things were closer together. Parts of the universe were closer to each other. And it's possible that different parts of the universe could have intersected with each other. That you have one bubble expanding, and then next door there's another bubble expanding, and they rub up against each other and even temporarily overlap. Now, this moment wouldn't have lasted very long. This epoch where it could have been possible would not have lasted very long, because then eventually the universes themselves would have expanded away from each other as they're continuing to expand. And that expansion away from each other is even faster than the expansion rate. So they're very, very far separated in space. And so they'll never intersect after that. But in the early universe, some intersections may have been possible. And we've looked for where these universes, bubbles, could have intersected with each other. And we look for them in the cosmic microwave background. The cosmic microwave background, if you don't already know, is probably the most important observation made in cosmology. And I'm not just saying that because, you know, like, I've done some work to help observe the cosmic microwave background, so I'm very personally attached to it. It's such a critical thing because it gives us a window into the early universe. It is leftover light from when the universe was only 270,000 years old. If you want a metaphor, that's like having a baby picture of you when you were only 7 seconds old. We have light that is 13.8 billion years old, reaching our telescopes right now, giving us a picture of the universe right now, as it was back then. And it could be that either in that epoch or earlier in the first 270,000 years that our bubble universe intersected with another bubble universe, what we would see, the observational effect of that, would be circles appearing in the cosmic microwave background. You can imagine if two soap bubbles rub up against each other, you look at where they intersect, they intersect to form a circle. And so we can look in the cosmic microwave background and look for interesting patterns of circles. Do any circle-like features appear in the cosmic microwave background? No. We tried, we looked, there's nothing within our detectable limits seeing a circle in the cosmic microwave background. This doesn't mean that there cannot be other bubble universes, quote unquote, parallel to our own, doing their own thing, being inside their own observable horizons and everything, but it doesn't look like they've intersected with ours. And so that severely constrains the range of possible cosmological models. We can't rule things out, but we can say, well, if there were other bubble universes formed, they have to have a certain limited set of properties, otherwise they would have rubbed up against ours and we would have seen it in the cosmic microwave background. So that's the current state of understanding, is that yes, there could be other bubble universes, observable patches. In fact, there most likely are, but they have not intersected with our universe and they will never intersect with our universe. And that's just it. So that's just one small slice of the multiverse pie. There's many, many different ways to introduce parallel universes, other universes, etc., etc., etc. In that one way, we do know that there's no observational evidence to support it. And that's it. So that's it. Effectively, this is the ultimate lesson of this research. Effectively, our universe is all we got. Our observable bubble is the only observable bubble we're ever going to have access to. It's the only thing we're ever going to see. This is it. This is it. Our set of galaxies, our set of stars and planets, potentially habitable worlds, our set of physics, everything. That is it. that's all we're going to get. So we might as well, like, quit searching for other things, for better universes with different physics. Just be happy with what you got. Learn to love the universe you're with. That is the ultimate lesson from that question. Thank you so much for that fantastic question from the Space Cadets, Yamagishi-san, on YouTube. This is Paul Sutter, and this is Space Reader. Remember, this show is brought to you by you. Visit patreon.com/PM Sutter to learn how you can support the show.
There's a new way to listen to Morning Edition. Wait, wait, don't tell me. News around the world and all your favorite programs. Simply say, Alexa, play NPR, anytime you want to be updated or want good company. Try Alexa, play NPR.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Paul Sutter. This is Space Ray, recording a special edition from the Grandview Theater in Columbus, Ohio. And I got a great question from Tommy Johansson asking about global warming and if it's about to be saved by the Maunder minimum, talking about solar cycles. So there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that the Earth has been warming over the past century or so. And yes, life in general would be fine in a warmer Earth. Our coastal cities and, you know, agriculture might suffer in the short term, which is what we really worry about. And the question is, okay, in the past 100 years or so, when we've noticed this spike, let's say, what's causing it? Would it have happened if there were no humans around on Earth? The answer is, it appears, again, a large amount of evidence suggests that it would not have happened if not for us. And we do have an explanation for it, which is increased carbon in the atmosphere, trapping heat. That is a very solid physical explanation for what we're seeing. So no, as the sun continues its cycles and goes back into a quiet phase, that's not going to really affect the climate here on Earth. That's not going to affect what's going to happen over the next half a decade, 50 years, 100 years, due to what people are doing to the atmosphere. So again, like you know, we can look for all possible explanations for what's happening with the Earth's climate, and we run down the list, and there's like only one thing left, and that one thing is a pretty strong smoking gun, and the smoke coming out of the gun is, of course, carbon. I'm not exactly sure where I was going with that metaphor, but I'm gonna run with it. There was one little bit of other news that I wanted to get to before the end of the show, and I don't have a lot of time. And that's this asteroid known as 2015 BZ509. Man, I wish we had better names for asteroids, because that does not roll off the tongue. Some researchers at the Côte d'Azur Observatory and the Sao Paulo State University did some analysis of this one particular asteroid. It's in the same orbit as Jupiter, so it's way out there, but it's orbiting in the opposite direction as basically everybody else. There's only very, very few objects that orbit backwards. And so they think maybe it came from somewhere else. Maybe as an interstellar visitor, like if you remember Oumuamua, the famous interstellar interloper from a few months ago. And maybe it got captured and ended up in this retrograde or reverse orbit. There's a lot of news going on about that. Like, hey, turns out we've had an interstellar visitor this whole time. Again, this research is peer-reviewed, it's published, it's fine. It doesn't make it correct. It doesn't make it necessarily correct. In fact, a lot of researchers think this particular analysis is flawed, that they didn't do enough long-term evolution in their dynamical models, that an object like this could arise naturally in our own solar system and end up in a retrograde or reverse orbit without having to come from somewhere else. And that's the game that science has played. Like, we come up with an idea, we run it through, we take our best guess as to explain this feature of nature, we advance a hypothesis, and that's not the only hypothesis to explain the available data. And we have to weigh the options. We have to weigh the options based on the evidence. So just because one research group says this is what they think, they could be right, but they could also be wrong. Thank you for the great questions from the Space Cadets online. But before we go, it's time for the Blue Shift. I'm Paul Sutter, and you're listening to Space Radio, and this is the Blue Shift, my opportunity to get a little bit closer to you. And in this show, I wanted to go back to those news stories that I picked out about the space octopus and about the interstellar visitor outstaying its welcome. I picked those on purpose because I wanted to talk about peer review. Usually, especially in the popular media, they'll say, well, hey, you know, this is a controversial idea. It might upset you. It might offend you, but it's been peer reviewed. It's published in a journal. So it's legit. Scientists are on board. And this is what scientists say. That is a mistake. Peer review is the first pass an idea gets. Peer review, and this is speaking as someone who has had my work peer reviewed, who has been a peer reviewer, peer review, you just check to make sure there's nothing outrageously wrong about the actual methods written down in the paper. That when they go from A to B, they didn't make some major mistake. That's what peer review is for. Their premise could be flawed. Their conclusions could be flawed. It could be just a total garbage paper. But if they laid out their arguments from A to B and did not make a mistake, it will generally pass peer review. Peer review does not mean the scientific community accepts the results. Peer review does not mean that the results of the paper are correct and to be believed. Peer review is the beginning. It means it's passed the very minimum threshold to be published, which means we think it should be shared with the scientific community. And that's a very small personal discussion between the authors of the paper, the referee, and the editor of the journal itself, that they've decided to like, okay, yeah, we'll go ahead. We'll send this out there. Just because a paper is peer reviewed does not mean it is correct. Like this space octopus story, the paper passed peer review. Okay. It's still wrong, but just because it's peer reviewed doesn't make it right. What you have to look at is the long-term relationship between that paper and the rest of the scientific community. Do other researchers continue to follow along the line and build more and more evidence along that conclusion? Or do they pile on and say, this is nonsense, and here's all the evidence that those researchers missed or forgot about or ignored? And that's where it goes. That's where you have to pay attention to. Science is a very, very slow process. Achingly slow. It takes years to decide and evaluate this work. And that's the kind of patience you need. So when you see a story, you see that it's peer-reviewed, take a breath. It doesn't necessarily mean it's correct. And unfortunately, this broadcast is almost done. Thank you for joining me on this voyage of space radio. Once again, I'm Paul Sutter, and this show is brought to you by the Ohio State University Department of Astronomy. Learn more at astronomy.osu.edu. This show is also brought to you by you. Visit patreon.com/PMSutter to learn how you can contribute. Thanks to Greg Mobius for producing, Dan Michalka for being awesome, Johnny DiLura for letting me crash his party at the Grandview Theater, and all the fine crew at WCBU Radio for making this show possible. We record every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Call 888-581-0708 to join me on the air. You can also catch the YouTube and Twitch live streams. Go to spaceradioshow.com for the links. You can also follow me directly on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. My name is at Paul Matt Sutter. And of course, thanks again, Earthlings, for listening. See you next week. And remember, science is for sharing. End of transmission.